You're listening to the I Love You Keep Going podcast with George Haas. For more information, please visit our website at www.metagroup.org. That's www.metagroup.org.
So welcome, everybody. This is I Love You Keep Going. It is October 26, 2023 at 7:36 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. And I've been having fun reading psychoanalytic literature and also reading about the Tibetan Book of the Dead and comparing the notions of death in each of these systems. And having a pretty good time at it. You know, just starting off to see the orientation of it, the author I was reading was, as explanation for homosexuality was that it's a denial of the aggression instinct in men, and that the reason that they bypass women is because they don't want to activate their aggression and engage in sexual conquest with women. Instead, they want to withhold their aggression and become passive for the father figure. This would not be the definition of the motivation for homosexuality that I would use, but I want to orient you toward the concepts here. The marvelous way in which people can make stuff up, and relating that to the nature of Buddhism, where we talk about this idea of we make stuff up, that is to say, we make the experience of reality from the selection of the sensing experiences that we choose. In the book on the review, really, of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, over and over again was the emphasis that you relate to it like a dream. And in this life, in this bardo of becoming, do you relate to this as if it's really happening, or is it really dreamlike, that you understand that it's something that you make up? When we talk about mentalizing, which you do quite a bit with the attachment material, understanding that when we fail to mentalize, we drop into a non-mentalizing stance of psychic equivalence, where you think that your version of reality that you create is the universal reality, that everybody is having that same experience, which allows you to give yourself permission to assign meaning to other people's reactions, other people's actions. Whereas in the mentalizing stance, what we're doing is saying, this is what I think is going on based on how I've created the experience of reality. What do you think is going on based on how you've made reality? So that capacity to sense meets the object that can be sensed, the consciousness arises. Not the self-consciousness yet, this is still not experienced by the self. Then it's evaluated for urgency of processing. Does it need immediate attention? Does it not matter whether it's processed consciously, or is it pleasant, and do we have time to experience something pleasant? Then it's compared to the perceptual database, and if there's an entry in the database that matches closely enough to what we're sensing, then that full thread of meaning attaches to the present moment, and it rolls into conceptual reality, which the self then experiences. Not making sense. And we don't do a neutral survey of the environment. We really do a highly curated selection of the mind moments that are organized around our preferences for experience. That's the reality that we create. So you could say that that's dreamlike in the sense that we make it up. It is, of course, based on our capacity to perceive what's happening and our preferences for things that are happening in the cacophony of what happens. And then to relate that to this understanding that we live in bodies that don't last that. And how do we regard that? So, in the psychoanalytic narrative that I was reading, the and I'm not telling you the author of what the book is because I want complete license to interpret it in the way that I want. Freud's initial theory, of course, was that it was all sexual instinct related. And that the organization of our motivations was really around sexual gratification and the experience of the child in relationship to the parents and the sexual drive of the child for the parents and how that works out. Obviously, we think that the parents are supposed to block the child from that, and that doesn't always happen. But if it did happen and it was solid enough of a block, that would redirect the child's sexual energy toward more attainable objects, sexual objects outside the family. And really reading about this, which is a shift in psychoanalytic thought that happened in the 1960s and 1970s, away from the sex drive to the death instinct, which was Freud's adaptation, to make the assign the death fear to sexual energy, whereas the case was being made in this particular treatise on the fear of death being the central driving force. What I found so interesting about that was the suggestion in that particular narrative that the way out of the death fear is to understand what happens after death. And the utility of a belief in a life after death. As human beings enabled in order to relieve that anxiety, that the difficulty of atheism or a strong agnosticism is that toward the end of your life, as you age and you have a more visceral experience of life ending, it leads to a despair, a depression that you're running out of time. There's nothing that you can do about it, and there's nothing that's going to come from that. And I was actually quite intrigued by that idea, having been atheistic and agnostic most of my life, and consciously thinking, that I'm actually kind of okay with this aging process and coming closer to the end. Most people, of course, die in their 70s. Twenty percent of people live beyond that into their 80s and 90s. In some sense, genetic. One conversation was that you get a longevity gene from each parent, and if you have two longevity genes, you'll live into your 80s and 90s, and if you don't have two longevity genes, you'll live into your 70s minus lifestyle, choices that you make along the way. So you age, the first 10 years or so are childhood, the second 10 years are adolescence, the third 10 years are youth. And in that whole process, you're growing and developing. It isn't until the end of the 20s that we actually begin aging. And so the understanding of the nature of all of this, I don't know that it's so possible in younger people. In the human condition, we don't actually to reach our full capacity to think clearly until we're in our mid-20s. That's the development process for us. So very slow to develop into this thinking person, 25 years or so. And then as you begin to age, you enter that middle period of life, 30, let's say, till 55 is that 25-year stretch of your adult life where you have all of those faculties in a body that works pretty good and good energy. And then another shift in energy. When I was in my late 20s, I was watching for this because I had heard it described so many times. And really, I don't think that precipitous drop in energy and that change in the way that my body functioned happened for me until my early 30s. It took that long. But then that second change between adult life and old age that happens in your sometimes in your mid-50s really happened pretty hard for me in my early 50s. So it was a surprising thing. And then you're in that span of old age, which lasts from 55 to 75. And then that 20% of people get old age, which something that maybe you could plan for, maybe not. I have a book that was sent to me that says that if you diet and exercise and take supplements, you can live to be 120, and that we should really begin to think about the normal human life being 120. So I Googled how many people who are 120 years or older are alive today. And you know what the number was? Zero.
George, you probably should have looked that up a couple of days before.
So we really look at all of that as, or at least I look at all of that as this denial of the reality of this human condition, the denial of death, the denial of aging. I think it has a benefit in the sense that it creates in our minds this idea that we can do it later. We can put it off. We don't have to get to it. We don't have to solve it. That there's going to be an endless amount of time in the future. And in practicing meditation and attempting to watch this process of how this experience of self and this experience of world is created, the duality that that experience often creates. When you come into a self experience and you identify the body as you and the internal experiences as you and the thought processes as you and the opinions as you and all of the rest of that. And that you see and experience the world as outside of that process, outside of yourself, existing independently of that process of understanding self, you know the experience of duality. This is me, that's the world, and they're different. They're created differently. I'm experiencing myself as this separate constant experience that then experiences other things separately. Is that making sense? When the self experience is part of the whole experience of sensing and determining what the sensing experience means, there is no difference between the sense of yourself and the sense of the world outside of yourself. It's the same experience of reality that you're creating. And so in meditation, you can sit into this and have direct experiences of that. This is what I make up in terms of who I think I am in this moment, and what is mine and what isn't mine, what agency I have or don't have. And that's the world that I'm affecting as one piece. Is that making sense? And so when you begin to recognize that, when you come into a negative state of mind, you can recognize that you're creating a negative state of mind and shift it into a positive state of mind. And when you notice the grabbiness of the way that the habitual habit of creating one experience or another unfolds, sometimes it takes a lot of effort to push into a different way of formulating things. But if you do it over and over again, it becomes less and less gripping because you see everything gives way to that recreation, that agency to recreate or change the way that you do it in the moment. Is that making sense? Each of the major religious ideas about life and death have these ideas about what happens after. One of the things about the Tibetan map that I find so interesting is that it relates directly to the practice that you do now so that you are prepared for these eventualities that will happen. And that in each of these eventualities present to you a choice that indicates where and in what way you'll be reincarnated if you don't choose a path out of reincarnation. It's sort of, you look at this list of choices that you have to all of the different realms that you can be, that you can transition into, and at the very end of the line practically is the human rebirth. Dan and Shinzen, in talking about this, often said a similar expression, that one of the reasons that monks are so lazy is because they think that they'll be reincarnated, so they don't have to get to the practice now. They don't have to get the understanding now because they have 1,000 lifetimes to explore the material. So one of the things about not thinking that is that there's a greater sense of need to do it now. I often think that puts us at this fork in the road. One direction is this full engagement of every moment with all of the energy that you have, that you're experiencing everything as much as you can without then clinging to it. And in the other direction is nihilism. Nihilism, in the colloquial way that we mean nihilism, which is that nothing matters. This isn't actually what nihilism says, but it is what's been popularized in our culture. Nihilism is very akin to the idea, the Buddhist idea, that there is no intrinsic meaning, no intrinsic value in something, not that nothing matters. It's a reaction to the Enlightenment, which in the Christian sense means that all things are manifestations of God. And all things are then directed and created by God, which is a sense of relinquishing responsibility, really, for the way that you operate in the world, since everything is fated, everything is mandated. So that nihilism, that response, is that nothing has intrinsic meaning to it. It's the meaning that we make and assign to it, which is different than everything being ordained and directed by God. In Western Buddhism, we don't talk so much about God. We don't talk so much about even reincarnation, I would say. Particularly in the Theravada side of things, I notice an absence of that. When I started sitting with Dan and going through the Bon teachings with him, Zach Oldenburg, a friend of mine, said, "Watch out, George. If you continue to sit with Dan, you're going to believe in reincarnation." And suddenly here I am talking about it 8 years or so later. But I tend to still, because of the way that my life happened, and so much of it was at such a rudimentary level, it was so difficult for me to function in the world, so difficult for me to reliably earn money and pay bills and show up for things, that I really became very narrowly focused on things that are practical, and not a lot of privilege for the exploration of more esoteric things. It seemed to be a level of functioning that was above what I had the bandwidth to attend to. And so I just simply left it unexamined and made belief choice about it. I was totally fine with the shorter term considerations of just trying to function. And so in some sense, the ability to consider these things now is actually quite enjoyable for me, because I haven't really had a stability where this was a possibility before. So the psychoanalytic idea that everything that we do is driven by the death fear and the avoidance of the reality of that experience. And I look around at our culture and I see that everywhere, very organized around that youthfulness, that denial of death, that to the point that being young is complementary and being old is not. And it also has an effect on the way that younger people regard older people and the wisdom collection that older people have. I was reading about some psychologists who figured out that as soon as an older person is unable to keep up with the latest app that is highly valued in the teens and 20s circle, all information from them is cut off. And so we're also in the experience now of this transmission of wisdom and this transmission of experience and this transmission of history being relegated not into these interpersonal exchanges, but into these apps and these conduits of corporate media, which create an extremely curated and limited reflection of what actually is happening. As compelling as a, you know, thirst trap TikTok is, and how many hours a day we can indulge in them. Does that really help us with the question of life and death and how we're oriented and what would be meaningful in life? And what you might find out from people. It's long been thought, of course, that because of the way that the cognitive mind forms in human beings, that really your awareness of culture and how that informs your participation in the world begins at around the age 15, and that you don't really track much that happens before that. So we all sort of start at age 15 and go forward. When I was a teenager, of course, and we all wanted to expand our profile and dress up and as a generational identity, I guess, is the thing we all do. When you have an older perspective, of course, what you watch is younger people do the same thing that you did in the current circumstance over and over again. And it's one of the frustrations of the human condition is that we come in with, you know, basically an empty understanding of anything. And then we all have to go through the same process of learning. There isn't this, and we don't live very long. And so these waves of knowledge that get passed down. But when we were coming up and we went to the thrift stores to buy clothes and to, you know, put them all together, the clothes that were ending up in the thrift stores were from the 30s and 40s. Very stylish. And so our identification around what was cool, and which was also being reflected in television. You don't know this maybe if you're not old enough, but when television first came out, it was black and white, and the way that they filled up the hours and hours of content on television was by releasing old movies. And so the 30s and 40s movies, you know, that early period after sound happened, and the clothes in the thrift store were kind of in sync, and so it created this this way of identifying ourselves. And then when you look at the way fashion returns in these cycles of 30 or 40 years, it really is the infusion of the clothes that end up in the thrift stores. And you know how the clothes end up in the thrift stores is somebody dies and they empty out their closets, and all of a sudden that they don't want them gets dumped in the thrift stores and hung on hangers. And so the fashion ideas recycle. Christian.
George, I think maybe someone stylish can correct me, but I think that cycle has entered like a death spiral where now it's like faster and faster. And like, I think kids are already like past what I was wearing in high school. And like, it's like a quicker and quicker cycle until, I don't know, like, I think it reaches some kind of singularity. And then I'm not sure what people are wearing.
Well, I would argue that hippie times are back, and that bell bottoms are common now, and longer hair on men is common. And I kind of enjoy that reflection back 40 years ago, or for me 50 plus years ago, when we were revolutionary. In the sense that it really bugged our parents. And so we knew that it was a good choice. The problem with some of that, of course, is that it gets pulled into the culture and accepted, and then it's no longer a good button to push to get a reaction from the parental set. And so we pick different things to push. And each generation finds the thing that they can push that causes the reaction, and then it gets assimilated to culture. Do you need to have the idea that there is a heaven, or that there is a reincarnation or some other idea? And is that idea useful in regulating the anxiety of the nature of the human condition to grow old, get sick, and die? And if that's so, is that useful? Can we leave it at that? Or does it require a stronger sense of belief to hold that idea? So I was wandering around the other day and I was thinking, okay, let me try on reincarnation and see if that idea actually relieves anxiety. This, you know, we're plagued by often anxiety, plagued often by depression. In meditation communities, of course, since it isn't quite mainstream, particularly if you retain some of the Buddhist context to it, the mindfulness is a little bit different because it's so stripped and sanitized. But people who come and are drawn to these kinds of expressions are usually coming because there's some suffering there that needs to be attended to, that hasn't responded as well to the normal cultural remedies to this. And also understanding as the Western society becomes increasingly more unequal, and the access to media is such that we can see the level of inequality and understand how culturally, we've been disadvantaged by the way that the system is. We look for an alternative to that. The central reward system that is so tightly curated in the media expression of what is desirable in culture is really not available to most of the people in our society. And how do you adjust to that, either being included where you have that ease of privilege, or being excluded where it's not really possible that you would be able to ever have what's being offered as the sources of satisfaction? And so what I find in the meditation community, on the one end, you have people that don't function very well and can't really get into competing. And then on the other end, people who compete very well and are pretty solid, but that don't find the reward system that's mainly offered to be that rewarding, and then looking for something else. If everything that we do is a dream, if everything we do is a creation of reality based on our conditioning, is there a particular fault in embracing the idea of reincarnation, or embracing the idea of heaven as a way of relieving the terrifying experience of understanding your death, such that it relieves you of that impediment to engage life? That would be the question that I would ask you. Can you operate in the world without that belief and not be undone by the anxiety of death? So these are things that I think are useful practice to explore that. What I really emphasize is this idea that we should go for this full engagement, as hard as we can with the energy that we have, and not head off into this nothing matters, it's not worth doing. Part of this nothing matters, it's not worth doing, really comes from the idea of avoiding the sadness of this loss. It isn't only the overall death of the human body, of course, but everything is impermanent. Everything ends. Nothing lasts. So you can go into the experience full on, and it's still not going to last. It's still going to end, these small moments of death. As the French say about orgasm, la petite mort. These small deaths. You think maybe I won't engage in it. If I don't get it, and I can't lose it, and so I can avoid the sadness of losing it. But it's lost in the moment that you don't go for it. And you don't avoid the sadness of that. But you don't get the experience of having it, which is where the richness, the meaningfulness of life comes from. Christian?
Sorry, George, I couldn't quite work out my joke, so I'm just going to leave this one on the floor.
I always say, if you can't risk flopping, if you can't risk bombing, you can't make jokes. So I totally hand that to you. One of the other things that I think is so interesting in terms of practice, and this is really the idea of how you practice. Shinzen used to say over and over again that the way you practice produces the experience that you have. And so the Theravada way of practicing is really organized around the experience of self and not self. And the Tibetan practice is really centered on this spacious identification with consciousness or awareness. And the Theravada expression of meditation tends to produce this movement between self and no self. And for me, in the beginning, this was very practical to come out of that very battered, very negative, ugly sense of self that was so deeply embedded based on the conditioning of my early childhood experiences that I then constructed reality out of. The constant anticipation of rejection, which was, and the fearfulness around harm that so characterized my 20s. And my inability to believe anything other than that, which was so limiting. The practical experience of noticing how reality is made and the ability to step out of those repetitive negative formulations to choose differently and then recognize a different outcome, moving in and out of the identification and experience of self. And then the later practice with the Tibetans, where really that spaciousness opens up a sense of sacredness in all things, which was completely foreign in terms of my experience of practice from the Theravada side. There was no sense of sacredness really at all. There was this very practical way of operating self and world that came from it. And then to come into this experience of all things being sacred and sitting in that view of sacredness, it's persuasive, at least it has been for me, in terms of the nature of the human experience as part of this very sacred whole experience, which I didn't get much from the Theravada practice. in one exchange with Dan Brown, he said, I don't understand why somebody would turn the first wheel of the Dharma if you could turn the third wheel of the Dharma. So the first wheel of the Dharma being the Theravada practices and the third wheel being the Tibetan. So, Chan or Zen is the second. And I said, I'm just trying to get across the street. I don't need to beam up to the spaceship and beam back down on the other side of the street. I just need to walk across the street, which he did not find amusing at all. So, anyway, I invite you to practice, and I invite you to explore this drivenness around death. So that it doesn't limit the things that you choose to do. Really, it is one of the more corralling or confining anxieties that we experience. And if we can get out of it, and then we tend to be freer in terms of the exploration toward meaningfulness. And really what we're looking for is time that we spend each day, not at the end of the week or when we're on vacation, but that we organize the way that we experience the world, the way that we spend our time and resources in the pursuit of this meaningfulness. And because each of us are so different and our conditioning is so different, what we find meaningful is really very idiosyncratic, very much our own. And that we have the sense of freedom to actually do that without the cultural inhibition of the value of it in terms of what the culture values. That we are free to really get into finding out what we find meaningful and then organizing our life in a way that we can do that. That making sense. Why don't we do some meditation now? I thought we would do a little bit of concentration to settle in and then do some Vipassana, see or feel, and then breaking it into focus in, focus out, and then adding the component of rest that we can move out of the identification of content into a recognition of sensing experience. All right, let go of the meditation. Any comments or questions on the practice? So we're going to offer a level one in December, so the four Saturdays of December. I think it's a good idea to infuse in everybody the understanding of attachment so that as the holidays unfold, you can view it through the archaeological lens of, oh God, this is my family system. And then in January, we're going to do a level two class, which is in the morning slot so that it's good for Europe as well. And I think that that's mainly what's coming up. I've just agreed to do a 2-week residential retreat in Poland in May. So maybe if you like to travel, that's something to consider. Then I'll do a commuter retreat in Utrecht, probably in June. So that's coming up. Thank you for your practice. Thanks for coming tonight. I really appreciate it. And I offer the teaching freely, but I do hope that if you're resourced, you can make a donation. There's a link on the website to make a donation. Any amount is helpful. It supports me and also the work Metagroup is doing. Really appreciate you. I've been doing bypassing visions, and so everybody looks incredibly beautiful. Nice to see you. I'll see you soon.